Welcome, everybody, to the Savitri Reading Circle on Infinite Conversations. This is Marco Vimarelli. I'm with Andrea Randelou and Jeffrey Jen Edwards. And we are going to continue our reading of Savitri. We are in Book Three, The Book of the Divine Mother, Canto Three, The House of the Spirit and the New Creation, which we began last week and got only a few pages in. So should we just pick it up from the beginning?
Sure.
Yeah. And we'll before that we'll begin with the meditation.
Book Three, The Book of the Divine Mother, Canto Three, The House of the Spirit and the New Creation. A mightier task remained than all he had done. To that he turned, from which all being comes, a sign attending from the secrecy which knows the truth ungrasped behind our thoughts and guards the world with its all-seeing gaze. In the unapproachable stillness of his soul, intense, one-pointed, monumental, lone, patient, he sat like an incarnate hope, motionless on a pedestal of prayer. A strength he sought that was not yet on earth. Help from a power too great for mortal will. The light of a truth now only seen afar. A sanction from his high omnipotent source. But from the appalling heights there stooped no voice. The timeless lids were closed. No opening came. A neutral, helpless void oppressed the years. In the texture of our bound humanity, he felt the stark resistance, huge and dumb, of our inconscient and unseeing base, the stubborn, mute rejection in life's depths, the ignorant no in the origin of things. A veiled collaboration with the night, even in himself, survived and hid from his view. Still, something in his earthly being kept its kinship with the inconscient whence it came. A shadowy unity with a vanished past, treasured in an old world frame, was lurking there, secret, unnoted by the illumined mind, and in subconscious whispers and in dream, still murmured at the mind's and spirit's choice.
Its treacherous element spread like slippery grains, hoping the incoming truth might stumble and fall. And old ideal voices wandering moaned and pleaded for heavenly leniency to the gracious imperfections of our earth and the sweet weakness of our mortal state. This now he willed to discover and exile, the element in him betraying God. All nature's recondite spaces were stripped bare, all her dim crypts and corners searched with fire, where refugee instincts and unshaped revolts could shelter, find in darkness sanctuary against the white purity of heaven's cleansing flame. All seemed to have perished that was undivine, yet some minutest dissident might escape and still a center lurk of the blind force. For the inconscient too is infinite. The more its abysses we insist to sound, the more it stretches endlessly. Then, lest a human cry should spoil the truth, he tore desire up from its bleeding roots and offered to the gods the vacant place. Thus could he bear the touch immaculate. A last and mightiest transformation came. His soul was all in front like a great sea, flooding the mind and body with its waves. His being spread to embrace the universe, united the within and the without, to make a life of cosmic harmony, an empire of the immanent divine. In this tremendous universality, not only his soul nature and mind sense included every soul and mind in his, but even the life of flesh and nerve was changed and grew one flesh and nerve with all that lives. He felt the joy of others as his joy. He bore the grief of others as his grief. His universal sympathy upbore, immense like ocean, the creation's load, as earth upbears all being sacrifice, thrilled with the hidden transcendent joy and peace.
There was no more division's endless scroll. One grew with the spirit's secret unity. All nature felt again the single bliss. There was no cleavage between soul and soul. There was no barrier between world and God. Overpowered were form and memory's limiting line. The covering mind was seized and torn apart. It was dissolved and now no more could be. The one consciousness that made the world was seen. All now was luminosity and force. Abolished in its last thin fainting trace, the circle of the little self was gone. The separate being could no more be felt. It disappeared and knew itself no more, lost in the spirit's wide identity. His nature grew a movement of the all, exploring itself to find that all was he. His soul was a delegation of the all that turned from itself to join the one supreme. Transcended was the human formula. Man's heart that had obscured the inviolable assumed the mighty beating of a god's. His seeking mind ceased in the truth that knows. His life was a flow of the universal life. He stood fulfilled on the world's highest line, awaiting the ascent beyond the world, awaiting the descent, the world to save. A splendor and a symbol wrapped the earth. Serene epiphanies looked and hallowed vasts surrounded, wise infinitudes were close, and bright remotenesses leaned near and kin.
Sense failed in that tremendous lucency. Ephemeral voices from his hearing fell, and thought, potent no more, sank large and pale like a tired god into mysterious seas. The robes of mortal thinking were cast down, leaving his knowledge bare to absolute sight. Fate's driving ceased and nature's sleepless spur. The athlete heavings of the will were stilled in the omnipotence unmoving peace. Life in his members lay down vast and mute, naked, unwalled, unterrified, it bore the immense regard of immortality. The last movement died, and all at once grew still. A weight that was the unseen transcendence hand laid on his limbs, the spirit's measureless seal. Infinity swallowed him into shoreless trance. As one who sets his sail towards mystery shores, driven through huge oceans by the breath of God, the fathomless below, the unknown around, his soul abandoned the blind star-filled space. Afar from all that makes the measured world, plunging to hidden eternities, it withdrew back from mind's foaming surface to the vasts, voiceless within us in omniscient sleep. Above the imperfect reach of word and thought, beyond the sight that seeks support of form, lost in deep tracts of superconscient light, or voyaging in blank featureless nothingness, soul in the trackless incommensurable, or past not self and self and selflessness, transgressing the dream shores of conscious mind, he reached at last his sempiternal base. On sorrowless heights, no winging cry disturbs, pure and untouched above this mortal play, is spread the spirit's hushed, immobile air.
There no beginning is, and there no end. There is the stable force of all that moves. There the aeonic laborer is at rest. There turns no key to creation in the void. No giant mechanism watched by a soul. There creaks no fate-turned huge machinery, the marriage of evil with good within one breast, a clash of strife in the very clasp of love, the dangerous pain of life's experiment in the values of inconsequence and chance, the peril of mind's gamble, throwing our lives at stake in a wager of indifferent gods, and the shifting lights and shadows of the idea falling upon the surface consciousness. And in the dream of a mute witness soul creating the error of a half-seen world where knowledge is a seeking ignorance, life steps a stumbling series without suit, its aspect of fortuitous design, its equal measure of true and false in that immobile and immutable realm find no access, no cause, no right to live. There only reigns the spirit's motionless power, poised in itself through still eternity and its omniscient and omnipotent peace. Thought clashes not with thought, and truth with truth. There is no war of right with rival right. There are no stumbling and half-seeing lives passing from chance to unexpected chance. No suffering of hearts compelled to beat in bodies of the inert inconscience make. Armed with the immune, occult, unsinking fire, the guardians of eternity keep its law forever fixed upon truth's giant base in her magnificent and termless home.
There nature on her dumb spiritual couch, immutably transcendent, knows her source, and to the stir of multitudinous worlds assents unmoved in a perpetual calm. All causing, all sustaining and aloof, the witness looks from his unshaken poise, an eye immense regarding all things done, apart, at peace above creation's stir, immersed in the eternal altitudes, he abode defended in his shoreless self, companioned only by the all-seeing one. A mind too mighty to be bound by thought, a life too boundless for the play in space, a soul without borders, unconvinced of time. He felt the extinction of the world's long pain. He became the unborn self that never dies. He joined the sessions of infinity. On the cosmic murmur, primal loneliness fell. Annulled was the contact formed with time-born things. Empty grew nature's wide community. All things were brought back to their formless seed. The world was silent for a cyclic hour. Although the afflicted nature he had left maintained beneath him her broad numberless fields, her enormous act, receding, failed remote, as if a soulless dream at last had ceased. No voice came down from the high silences. None answered from her desolate solitudes. A stillness of cessation reigned, the wide immortal hush before the gods are born. A universal force awaited, mute, the veiled transcendence's ultimate decree. Shall we pause there?
There were some things I needed to go over here.
What are you wondering about?
Well, it was this whole passage, but I'm still not trying. I'm just trying to sort of read it and make sense of it. So middle of page 321, and the dream of a mute witness soul, creating the error of a half-seen world where knowledge is a seeking ignorance. It's the grammar, I think, in that immobile and immutable realm, find no axis, no cause, no right to live. I got stuck with the find no axis following the stuff before, because the grammar was a bit heavy somehow. I don't know.
Yeah, it is. There's a whole lot all pulled together. And my feeling is that this is like this in-between moment where he is poised in the eternal silence. And then he reflects on all the perils of life and mind down here. And so it, right after this break, then a change comes, then something comes to him. This is like this vast silence where he is above all the perils of life and mind.
Yeah, I think I get it. It's just that the grammar tripped me up there. That's all.
Well, what is that sentence? So the it begins all the way up, 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 up. Where is it? There turns no keyed. Is this it?
Yeah, there that's turns, the beginning.
There turns no keyed creation in the void. No giant mechanism watched by a soul. Hold on. Before we go further, at the very beginning of this section, it's like he's traveling again, right? And this is the book of, or there was a book of the Traveler of the Worlds. We're no longer in that book, but we're still traveling.
He's waiting. He's waiting. He reached this peak above, and now he is waiting. He's no longer seeking. He knows. He sits on the pedestal of prayer in silence. That's in the first part of this, remember?
Right.
He's just completely immobile. And then, of course, he writes all this.
I almost thought there was a little, kind of like a, what's the word, falling back, because in the previous book, before the Book of the Divine Mother, we had been in a similar space, a kind of witness consciousness that is withdrawn from the world, is not participating in the world. And it seems like we're there again here.
Yeah.
Except
he is in a higher place. He is above, he is now separated from the lower world, as it were, right? He's left it behind. He's in the silence of the absolute, waiting. And then he reflects back on, you know, what's underneath.
There was that vast surrender.
Yeah.
So that's why you're saying he's no longer seeking and that he's...
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. The life in his members lay down, vast and mute, that is just before that section. Naked, unwalled, unterrified, it bore the immense regard of immortality. The last movement died and all at once grew still. A weight that was the unseen transcendent hand laid on his limbs, the spirit's measureless seal. Infinity swallowed him into shoreless trance. That's where he is. And now.
Okay, I see. Would you like to continue reading from that next section?
That makes sense, yeah. Then suddenly there came a downward look, as if a sea exploring its own depths, a living oneness widened at its core and joined him to unnumbered multitudes. A bliss, a light, a power, a flame-white love caught all into a soul immense embrace. Existence found its truth on oneness breast, and each became the self and space of all. The great world rhythms were heartbeats of one soul. To feel was a flame discovery of God. All mind was a single harp of many strings. All life a song of many meeting lives. For worlds were many, but the self was one. This knowledge now was made a cosmos seed. This seed was cased in the safety of the light. It needed not a sheath of ignorance. Then, from the trance of that tremendous clasp, and from the throbbings of that single heart, and from the naked spirit's victory, a new and marvelous creation rose. Incalculable outflowing infinitudes, laughing out an unmeasured happiness, lived their innumerable unity. Worlds were where the being is unbound and wide, bodied unthinkably the egoless self. Worlds where the being is unbound and wide, where the being is unbound and wide-bodied. No, sorry. Worlds where the being is unbound and wide, bodied unthinkably the egoless self. Rapture of beatific energies joined time to the timeless, poles of a single joy. White vasts were seen where all is wrapped in all. There were no contraries, no sundered parts. All by spiritual links were joined to all and bound indissolubly to the one. Each was unique, but took all lives as his own. And following out these tones of the infinite, recognized in himself the universe. A splendid center of infinity's whirl pushed to its zenith's height, its last expanse, felt the divinity of its own self-bliss repeated in its numberless other selves. It took up tirelessly into its scope persons and figures of the impersonal, as if prolonging in a ceaseless count, in a rapturous multiplication sum, the recurring decimals of eternity.
None was apart. None lived for himself alone. Each lived for God in him and God in all. Each soulness inexpressibly held the whole. Their oneness was not tied to monotone. It showed a thousand aspects of itself, its calm, immutable stability, upbore on a changeless ground, forever safe, compelled to a spontaneous servitude, the ever-changing, incalculable steps, the seeming reckless dance's subtle plan of immense world forces in their perfect play. Appearance looked back to its hidden truth and made of difference oneness, smiling play. It made all persons fractions of the unique, yet all were beings' secret integers. All struggle was turned to a sweet strife of love in the harmonized circle of a sure embrace. Identity's reconciling happiness gave a rich security to difference. On a meeting line of hazardous extremes, the game of games was played to its breaking point, where through self-finding by divine self-loss, there leaps our unity's supreme delight, whose blissful undivided sweetness feels a communality of the absolute. There was no sob of suffering anywhere. Experience ran from point to point of joy. Bliss was the pure undying truth of things. All nature was a conscient front of God. A wisdom worked in all, self-moved, self-sure, a plenitude of illimitable light, an authenticity of intuitive truth, a glory and passion of creative force.
Infallible, leaping from eternity, the moment's thought inspired the passing act. A word, a laughter, sprang from silence's breast. A rhythm of beauty in the calm of space. A knowledge in the fathomless heart of time. All turned to all without reserves recoil. A single ecstasy without a break. Love was a close and thrilled identity in the throbbing heart of all that luminous life. A universal vision that unites, a sympathy of nerve replying to nerve, hearing that listens to thought's inner sound and follows the rhythmic meanings of the heart. A touch that needs not hands to feel, to clasp, were there the native means of consciousness, and heightened the intimacy of soul with soul, a grand orchestra of spiritual powers, a diapason of soul interchange, harmonized a oneness deep, immeasurable. In these new worlds projected, he became a portion of the universal gaze, a station of the all-inhabiting light, a ripple on a single sea of peace. His mind answered to countless communing minds. His words were syllables of the cosmos's speech, his life a field of the vast cosmic stir. He felt the footsteps of a million wills moving in unison to a single goal. A stream, ever newborn that never dies, caught in its thousandfold currents, ravishing flow, with eddies of immortal sweetness thrilled, he bore coiling through his members as they passed, calm movements of interminable delight. The bliss of a myriad myriads who are one.
Do we need a break?
No, I think I'm good.
Okay. I do have a question. So, I don't remember exactly where, but there was a point where we met the world soul, and that kind of multitude, that plenitude of all beings that are manifestations of the One. And we're back, it seems like we're back to that now, but I'm wondering, how is this that like higher turn in the spiral, or how would you characterize?
I think he is now fully embodying that. He is at one with the world soul and with all beings. He is in that state of divine consciousness where everything is a part of it. And that is where he is. It's like beyond our imagination. He's describing the supramental consciousness right here.
And before it was more like encountering the world soul rather than being it.
And a description of what it is, of what he saw, and now he is that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I can follow that.
He is now in this soul immense embrace. He's caught, caught all into a soul immense embrace. Existence found its truth on oneness breast, and each became the self and space of all. That is where he is. Yeah, shall I?
Yeah. Well, I like the play of identity and difference here, and the way that he characterizes those. And the game of games was played to its breaking point, where through self-finding by divine self-loss, there leaps out unity's supreme delight. So there's maybe this recognition of the...
Yeah. When you look at a photograph of Sri Aurobindo, the older Sri Aurobindo, this is what I see. In these new worlds projected, he became a portion of the universal gaze, a station of the all-inhabiting light, a ripple on a single sea of peace. His mind answered to countless communing minds. This is, I believe, exactly how he was. He was responding to everyone. He knew everyone. Everyone could write to him. He would write them letters. He wrote thousands of letters, and he is sitting there, a station of the all-inhabiting light. He's not moving. I mean, he walks up and down in his room, but but internally he is, and he has that. To me, it's like if there ever was an image of God, there it is. It's a completely, the gaze is a portion of the universal gaze. It's just there. Yeah. Shall I continue? In this vast outbreak of perfection's law, imposing its fixity on the flux of things, he saw a hierarchy of lucent planes and fiofed to this highest kingdom of God's state. Attuning to one truth, their own right rule, each housed the gladness of a bright degree, alone in beauty, perfect in self-kind, an image cast by one deep truth's absolute, married to all in happy difference. Each gave its powers to help its neighbor's parts, but suffered no diminution by the gift. Profiteers of a mystic interchange, they grew by what they took and what they gave. All others they felt as their own complements, one in the might and joy of multitude. even in the poise where oneness draws apart to feel the rapture of its separate selves, the soul in its solitude yearned towards the all, and the many turned to look back at the one. An all-revealing, all-creating bliss, seeking for forms to manifest truths divine, aligned in their significant mystery, the gleams of the symbols of the ineffable blazoned like hues upon a colorless air on the white purity of the witness soul. These hues were the very prism of the Supreme, his beauty, power, delight, creation's cause. A vast truth consciousness took up these signs to pass them on to some divine child heart that looked on them with laughter and delight, enjoyed in these transcendent images, living and real as the truths they house. The spirit's white neutrality became a playground of miracles, a rendezvous for the secret powers of a mystic timelessness. It made of space a marvel house of God. It poured through time its works of ageless might, unveiled, seen as a luring, rapturous face, the wonder and beauty of its love and force.
The eternal goddess moved in her cosmic house, sporting with God as a mother with her child. To him, the universe was her bosom of love. His toys were the immortal verities. All here, self-lost, had there its divine place. The powers that here betray our hearts and air were there sovereign in truth, perfect in joy, masters in a creation without flaw, possessors of their own infinitude. Their mind, a splendid sun of vision's rays, shaped substance by the glory of its thoughts and moved amidst the grandeur of its dreams. Imagination's great ensorceling rod summoned the unknown and gave to it a home. Outspread luxuriantly in golden air, truth's iris-colored wings of fantasy, or sang to the intuitive heart of joy, wonders, dream notes that bring the real close. It's powers that make the unknowable near and true. In the temple of the ideal shrine, the one. It peopled thought and mind and happy sense, filled with bright aspects of the might of God and living persons of the one supreme. The speech that voices the ineffable, the ray revealing unseen presences, the virgin forms through which the formless shines, the word that ushers divine experience and the ideas that crowd the infinite. There was no gulf between the thought and fact. Ever they replied like bird to calling bird. The will obeyed the thought, the act, the will. There was a harmony woven twixt soul and soul, a marriage with eternity, divinized time. Their life pursued, unwearied of her sport, joy in her heart and laughter on her lips, the bright adventure of God's game of chance.
In her ingenious ardor of caprice, in her transfiguring mirth, she mapped on time, a fascinating puzzle of events. Lured at each turn by new vicissitudes to self-discovery that could never cease. Ever she framed stark bonds for the will to break, brought new creations for the thought's surprise, and passionate ventures for the heart to dare, where truth recurred with an unexpected face, or else repeated old familiar joy like the return of a delightful rhyme. At hide and seek on a mother wisdom's breast, an artist teeming with her world idea. She never could exhaust its numberless thoughts and vast adventure into thinking shapes and trial and lure of a new living's dreams. Untired of the sameness and untired of change, endlessly she unrolled her moving act, a mystery drama of divine delight, a living poem of world ecstasy, a kakemono of significant forms, a coiled perspective of developing scenes, a brilliant chase of self-revealing shapes, an ardent hunt of soul looking for soul, a seeking and a finding as of gods. There, matter is the spirit's firm density, an artistry of glad outwardness of self, a treasure house of lasting images where sense can build a world of pure delight, the home of a perpetual happiness. It lodged the hours as in a pleasant inn. The senses there were outlets of the soul. Even the youngest child thought of the mind incarnated some touch of highest things.
Their substance was a resonant harp of self, a net for the constant lightnings of the spirit, a magnet power of love's intensity, whose yearning throb and adoration's cry drew God's approaches close, sweet, wonderful. Its solidity was a mass of heavenly make. Its fixity and sweet permanence of charm made a bright pedestal for felicity. Its bodies, woven by a divine sense, prolonged the nearness of soul's clasp with soul. Its warm play of external sight and touch reflected the glow and thrill of the heart's joy. Mind's climbing brilliant thoughts, the spirit's bliss, life's rapture kept forever its flame and cry. All that now passes lived immortal there, in the proud beauty and fine harmony of matter plastic to spiritual light. Its ordered hours proclaimed the eternal law. Vision reposed on a safety of deathless forms. Time was eternity's transparent robe. An architect hewing out self's living rock, phenomenon built reality's summer house on the beaches of the sea of infinity.
So Aurobindo always surprises me. He's managed to introduce two words that I have never seen before in my life. And Fjoft. And Kakemono.
There's also ensorcelling rod. Have you ever heard ensorcelling?
No, but at least it has. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Ah, John Robert.
You guys finished?
Oh, no, we're right in the middle, smack in the middle of the... It's amazing.
So Enfioff, my dictionary says, is under the feudal system, give someone freehold property or land in exchange for their pledged service. And kakemono is a Japanese unframed painting made on paper or silk and displayed as a wall hanging.
Thank you.
And what
I love it when I learn a new word, though.
What about ensorcelling? What does that mean?
Isn't that, well,
where is that? Where is that?
Page 327, 15 lines down.
Fascinating.
Enchanting.
That's what I thought, yeah.
Enchanting.
Okay. Phenomena built reality's summer house on the beaches of the Sea of Infinity.
Yeah.
trying to think of what's that famous resort in France? Remind me.
On the Mediterranean.
Yeah.
You mean like Juan de Lepin or something like that?
No, the other one. Oh, well, it'll come to me. Kind of reminded me of that. A summer getaway for phenomena. The Riviera, the French Riviera, is that it?
Right. Yeah, but it's not exactly a resort. It's the whole coast.
Okay. Shall I finish this page and then John Robert take the next page?
What page are you on?
We're on page 329 at the break, Against This Glory.
Oh, okay.
So how about John Robert, Jeffrey, and then I'll finish it off from there.
Okay, and I'll finish this page.
Okay.
Against this glory of spiritual states, their parallels and yet their opposites, floated and swayed, eclipsed and shadow-like, as if a doubt made substance, flickering, pale, this other scheme. Two vast negations found. A world that knows not its inhabiting self, labors to find its cause and need to be. A spirit ignorant of the world it made, obscured by matter, travestied by life, struggles to emerge, to be free, to know and reign. These were close tied in one disharmony. Yet the divergent lines met not at all.
Three powers governed its irrational course. In the beginning, an unknowing force. In the middle, an embodied, striving soul. In its end, a silent spirit denying life. A dull and infelicitous interlude unrolls its dubious truth to a questioning mind, compelled by the ignorant power to play its part and to record her inconclusive tale. The mystery of her inconscient plan and the riddle of a being born from night by a marriage of necessity with chance. This darkness hides our nobler destiny. A chrysalis of a great and glorious truth, it stifles the winged marvel in its sheath, lest from the prison of matter it escape, and wasting its beauty on the formless vast, merged into the unknowable's mystery, leave unfulfilled the world's miraculous fate. As yet thought only some high spirit's dream, or vexed illusion in man's toiling mind. A new creation from the old shall rise. A knowledge inarticulate finds speech. Beauty suppressed burst into paradise bloom. Pleasure and pain dive into absolute bliss. A tongueless oracle shall speak at last. The superconscient, conscious grow on earth. the eternal's wonders join the dance of time. But now, all seemed a vainly teeming vast, upheld by a deluded energy to a spectator half absorbed and mute, careless of the unmeaning show he watched, regarding the bizarre procession pass like one who waits for an expected end. He saw a world that is from a world to be.
There he divined rather than saw or felt, far off upon the rim of consciousness, transient and frail, this little whirling globe, and on it left, like a lost dream's vain mold, a fragile copy of the spirit's shell, his body gathered into mystic sleep, a foreign shape it seemed, a mythic shade. Want to stop there, or only got a little way to go now? So,
I can wait till the end.
Yeah, I'll keep going then. Alien now seemed that dim, far universe, self and eternity alone were true. Then memory climbed to him from the striving plains, bringing a cry from once loved, cherished things. And to the cry, as to its own lost call, a ray replied from the occult supreme. For even there the boundless oneness dwells. To its own sight unrecognizable, it lived still sunk in its own tenebrous seas, upholding the world's inconscient unity, hidden in matter's insentient multitude. This seed self, sown in the indeterminate, forfeits its glory of divinity, concealing the omnipotence of its force, concealing the omniscience of its soul. An agent of its own transcendent will, it merges knowledge in the inconscient deep, accepting error, sorrow, death, and pain, it pays the ransom of the ignorant night, redeeming by its substance nature's fall. Himself he knew, and why his soul had gone into earth's passionate obscurity, to share the labor of an errant power by which division hopes to find the one. Two beings he was, one wide and free above, one struggling, bound, intense, its portion here. A tie between them still could bridge two worlds. There was a dim response, a distant breath. All had not ceased in the unbounded hush.
His heart lay somewhere conscious and alone, far down below him like a lamp in night. Abandoned it lay, alone, imperishable, immobile with excess of passionate will, his living, sacrificed and offered heart, absorbed in adoration mystical, turned to its far-off fount of light and love. In the luminous stillness of its mute appeal, it looked up to the heights it could not see. It yearned for from the longing depths it could not leave. In the center of his vast and fateful trance, halfway between his free and fallen selves, interceding twixt God's day and the mortal's night, accepting worship as its single law, accepting bliss as the sole cause of things, refusing the austere joy which none can share, refusing the calm that lives for calm alone, to her it turned for whom it willed to be. In the passion of its solitary dream, it lay like a closed, soundless oratory where sleeps a consecrated argent floor, lit by a single and untrembling ray, and an invisible presence kneels in prayer. On some deep breast of liberating peace, all else was satisfied with quietude. This only knew there was a truth beyond. All other parts were dumb in centered sleep, consenting to the slow, deliberate power which tolerates the world's error and its grief, consenting to the cosmic long delay, timelessly waiting through the patient years, her coming they had asked for earth and men. This was the fiery point that called her now. Extinction could not quench that lonely fire. Its seeing filled the blank of mind and will. Thought dead, its changeless force abode and grew. Armed with the intuition of a bliss to which some moved, tranquility was the key. It persevered through life's huge emptiness amid the blank denials of the world. It sent its voiceless prayer to the unknown. It listened for the footsteps of its hopes, returning through the void immensities. It waited for the fiat of the word that comes through the still self from the supreme. End of Canto 3. Sometimes when I'm reading, I'm not hearing the words as well as when I'm listening to one of you read. So I'm not quite sure what I just read. Savitri, is she being invoked here?
The mother, the divine mother, is being invoked, whom he's already met before.
Savitri will come down as an embodiment of her. So this is the Divine Mother itself, herself.
Okay.
I'm really struck. I feel like I've never read this before. To really see how he split in two. He had this, and then he had his little human heart. It's like he is us, and he is the next step at the same time.
And it's the human heart that's powerful. That issues the call.
Mm-hmm.
And she responds to that.
Mm. Makes me cry.
I think this is where Sri Aurobindo, in this book, where he seems like suddenly turns to the heart, whereas before it's been this ascent. I'm not sure, but there's a place in Savitri in the whole book where all of a sudden he starts talking about the heart and the call of the heart. I don't know if this is the beginning of it or not.
I see the heart here at the top of that page, his living, sacrificed, and offered heart, absorbed in adoration mystical, turned to its far-off fount of light and love. It looked up to the heights it could not see.
Let me see if I could reconstruct what just happened. So we founded this Divine Mother, right? And then there's a kind of like, how would I put this, turning back upon the pure self, the witness self. And then there is this like explosive, like cosmic, like experience of being the all, the one and all in one, all things related to all things, all thing. And then from there, and that's described as a trance as well. So it's this, the very, very far distant, like the world seems like a distant, not illusory, but it's kind of lost. The perspective almost loses touch with the world, and then there's a kind of return or the splitting that you describe between the free self and the fettered self. Two beings he was, one wide and free above, one struggling, bound, intense, its portion here. But just before that, he, at the beginning of the previous section on 329, he begins that against this glory of spiritual states, all of that multitude, that plenum, their parallels and yet their opposites floated and swayed, eclipsed and shadow-like, as if a doubt-made substance flickering pale. This other scheme, two vast negations found. So there are these two vast negations. One is the world that knows not its inhabiting self. So that's kind of the ignorance of everything that is not self-aware. And then the spirit, from the other direction, ignorant of the world it made. So that's like this dissociated witness kind of consciousness. And then there's disharmony into this. It was very blissful for a while. And now there's this element of disharmony. And these divergent lines meant not at all. Three powers governed its irrational course. In the beginning, an unknowing force. In the middle, the embodied striving soul. And in its end, a silent spring denying life, which I took to mean death. So life, and then the sort of root cause of life, and then the struggle of living beings, and then the death of those living beings, the death of life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then he sees the world, and he's like, whoa, wait a minute. I forgot about that, and then that self cries out for the one, cries out for the mother, and that's where we're left. Which I like actually, because that's, I mean, we're in the world, the striving, struggling world, and that connection between the world and the self.
Yes, he's coming back for us.
Don't leave yet.
On page 331 at the bottom, he says, a tie between them still could bridge two worlds. And then he starts talking about the heart.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like a lamp in far down below him, like a lamp in night. Love that line.
Abandoned it lay.
Mm-hmm.
Immobile with excess of passionate will. It's like, you know, it's got a lot pent up.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, and I love these lines. And accepting worship as its single law, accepting bliss as the sole cause of things, refusing the austere joy which none can share, refusing the calm that lives for calm alone, to her it turned, for whom it willed to be. This is where the heart now turns to the Divine Mother and says, yes. That's what I want.
And this is also another.
Go ahead, John Robert.
This is also another place where Sri Aurobindo makes explicit that this yoga is not about austerity. Excuse me, about austerity and individual salvation, refusing the calm that lives for calm alone.
Yeah.
So in the middle of page 330, a new creation from the old shall rise, and knowledge inarticulate find speech. The title of the canto is about the new creation. So can you help me with this? I'm still trying to untangle the pieces.
Well, that would be that mysterious supramental creation, when that all consciousness actually can get embodied in us and live on the planet. That's the journey. And that he's describing what that will look like. Their knowledge will not need speech.
So he has this vision of the new creation, and then when he meets the mother in, I think it's in the Vision and the Boon, the last canto in this book, he describes what he saw to her. So it's like he goes back and it's some very famous lines from Savitri, where he sees the beginning of this new world coming. We'll get to that the next time or two. But he has the vision of it here.
Right.
And you keep saying Aurobindo and not Ashwapati.
Oh, did I say Sri Aurobindo?
Yes.
Yeah, well, it's Ashwapati, but of course it's Sri Aurobindo talking about what he saw and using Ashwapati's name and story as a way to tell it.
Poetic voice.
I love how he describes a little bit above that the earth as a chrysalis of a great and glorious truth. The whole metaphor of the what's that called before it becomes a butterfly?
Caterpillar?
The cocoon, right? The cocoon is the chrysalis. It stifled the winged marvel in its sheath. lest from the prison of matter it escape, and wasting its beauty on the formless vast. We want it here.
So this is kind of the pivotal moment, I guess, in the story, because I gather the boon is the descent of Savitri. Is that right? And so this is the vision that leads to the boon that leads to the whole rest, next part of the remainder of the story.
Yeah.
And what about the house of spirit? Because I got the new creation part, but where does the house come in this canto?
It's a dwelling place, right? It's a metaphor for where we are,
If I'd been with you all with the first part of reading of this canto, I might have something to say about that. But this canto, I've noticed, it doesn't stay with me. Some of the other ones, you know, the action and the imagery, but this one is like so far away. It seems so far away. This is this thing that Sri Aurobindo calls the supramental. And one of the writers about the integral yoga, George and Reckham, says it's really just a technical term that about something we can't imagine. And so Sri Aurobindo describes it here, but it's like, it just goes woof like that after I've read it.
So it felt very abstract when I was reading it. So you're saying it's not just me.
Yeah, when I'm reading it, it's something about his words touches me. But when I leave, it's like a dream went by and I can't remember the dream anymore.
Although to be fair, he uses a lot of sensual imagery to describe this abstract thing, right? So
yeah, he really does. He uses blizzards of imagery in this whole epic.
Well, we are ultimately all a manifestation of that bliss, right? That's what this whole thing is. We're just behind a veil.
But there was an important, I think, point to at the beginning of the canto, maybe, I don't know, helps to situate what's going on here and maybe why it's hard. He says, a mightier task remained than all he had done. And then a couple lines down, a strength he sought that was not yet on earth, help from a power too great for mortal will. And this is just before he goes on to speak about the veiled collaboration with night, those parts of oneself that remain disconnected or ignorant, or it's a collaboration, so like actively participating in ignorance and in error, and this kind of like rooting out, it seems like this is about purification.
And how deeply we are attached to the darkness and the suffering. Because that's what we know. That's our familiar. And he describes it in himself. That there it is. The veiled collaboration with the night, even in himself, survived. And hid from his view. It's like this perfect description of the subconscious that we all live in.
This was the part we read last time, last week, the prayer, the very first section.
Yeah.
He tears desire up from its bleeding roots.
Ouch.
And offered to the gods the vacant place. And there was this, I guess, purifying or, I didn't know how to take that completely. It seemed a little bit like how that those are metaphors for you know how you deal with the darkness, but it seemed to happen a little quickly. And on the other hand, at the very end, there is this sense of how long it takes, the long delay, the cosmic delay, and the perseverance required. It persevered through life's huge emptiness amid the blank denials of the world. And then earlier, consenting to the cosmic long delay, tirelessly waiting through the patient years. Her coming, they had asked for earth and men. Oh man, that's what get the time is what. Is what gets me, like when we feel that we're in the middle of a very long process that is nowhere near being done. That's I think what that's my pain point at the moment.
Somebody has I don't remember his name, it's a psychologist, has coined the term, I guess I never heard it before. He calls it the long dark.
Right. Right, we were talking about that in the context of collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. By the way, John Robert, I was so grateful for that article you wrote about the Grand Canyon. Thank you.
You're welcome.
We all live in the gap in between.
I got my copy. So this is for anyone watching this, this is a reference to Collaboration Journal, which you can learn more about at collaboration.org/journal, I believe. And the new edition is just out. 46th year, I believe.
Wow.
Yeah.
So next time we'll go through this whole one again, huh?
And then we have the vision and the boon.
Yep.
And that would be the end of part one, actually, of Savitri. So that'll be another milestone coming up, I guess, later this month. Maybe beginning of next month, depending on how it goes.
Yeah,
then the whole tenor of the epic changes and it becomes Savitri's story instead of Ashwapati's story.
Yeah.
And as far as I can tell, we're just about halfway, so.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
So two more years to go.
Okay. And a few more centuries, probably.
I think Ursula K. Le Guin, you quote this in Plenum, Jeffrey. It's one of the notes from the compendium, the all-human compendium that begins each of the chapters. She talks about how important it is to get time on your side rather than struggling against time. That's one I'm still working on. But brought into relief by this whole process.
I think it's a kind of relaxation, right? A slowing down. Like you said, you've been trying to slow yourself down. So I think that's part of it.
But it's not happening fast enough.
Yeah.
I'm still collaborating with the night, I think. All right. Well, this has been really great. A nice session. Thank you.
Do you want to do a meditation to finish up?
Yes, please.
Thanks, everybody. Good to see you all.
Thank you. See you next time.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Hey.
Bye-bye.
Glad you can make it, John Robert.
Yeah. Glad I made it for a little while anyway.
Yeah.
Thanks.